Disc 2.
Deciding on the tax increases was no easier than choosing the budget cuts. The toughest issue for me was the BTU tax. It was bad enough that I was going back on my commitment to cut middle-class taxes. Now I was told we had to raise them, both to reach the $140 billion deficit reduction target in the fifth year and to turn the psychology of the bond market. The middle class had been shafted in the 80s, and Bush had been crippled by signing a gas tax increase. In one fell swoop, if I proposed the BTU tax, I would make the Republicans the anti-tax party again, largely to satisfy the hunger of the prosperous interest rate setters for a little middle class pain, in this case about $9 a month in direct costs, rising to $17 when indirect costs in the form of higher prices for consumer products were included. Lloyd Benson said that he had never had any fallout from voting for energy taxes, and that Bush was hurt by signing the 1990 gas tax increase because of his Read My Lips pledge and the fact that the most militant anti-taxers were hardcore Republicans. Gore again pushed for the BTU tax, saying it would promote energy conservation and independence. Finally, I gave in, but made some other changes in Treasury's tax proposals that I hoped would reduce the tax burden on average Americans. I insisted that we include in the budget the full $26.8 billion cost of my campaign proposal to more than double the tax cut for millions of working families with incomes of $30,000 or less, called the Earned Income Tax Credit, EITC. And for the first time, offer a more modest EITC to more than 4 million working poor Americans without dependents. This proposal would ensure that even with the energy tax, working families with incomes of $30,000 or less would still receive a meaningful tax cut. On the campaign trail, I had said at virtually every stop, no one with children who works full-time should live in poverty. In 1993, there were a lot of people in that situation. After we doubled the EITC, more than 4 million of them moved out of poverty into the middle class during my presidency. As we were trying to close the deal, Laura Tyson said she felt she had to point out that there was no significant economic difference between a fifth-year reduction of $140 billion and one of $120 or $125 billion. Congress would probably pare back whatever I proposed anyway. She argued that if it eased our political problems or was simply better policy, we could save ourselves some headaches by reducing the figure to $135 billion or even a little less. Reich, Sperling, Blonder, Begala, and Stephanopoulos all agreed with her. The others held out for the high number. Benson said we could save $3 billion by dropping the estimated cost of welfare reform from the budget. I agreed. After all, we hadn't developed our proposal yet, and the number was just a guess. We knew we'd have to spend more on training, child care, and transportation to help poor people move from welfare to work, but if we moved enough people off the rolls, the net cost might go down, not up. Moreover, I believed we could pass welfare reform separately with bipartisan support. Later, Lloyd Benson added a final piece to the plan, removing the $135,000 earnings cap on the 1.45% payroll tax that funded Medicare. This was necessary to make sure that our numbers on extending Medicare's solvency added up. But it did ask for more from the wealthiest Americans, whose top rate we were already proposing to raise to 39.6%, and who would almost certainly never cost the Medicare program as much as they would now pay into it. When I asked Benson about it, he just smiled and said he knew what he was doing. He was confident that he and other high-income Americans who would pay the extra tax would more than make it back in the stock market boom that our economic program would spark. On Monday, February 15th, I gave my first televised address from the Oval Office, a 10-minute outline of the economic program I would unveil 2 days later to a joint session of Congress. Even though the economy was in a statistical recovery, it was a jobless one, burdened by the quadrupling of the debt in the last 12 years. Since all the deficits were the result of the tax cuts for the wealthy, soaring health costs, and increases in defense spending, we were investing less in the things that make us stronger and smarter, richer and safer, like education, children, transportation, and local law enforcement. At the rate we were going, our living standards, which usually doubled every 25 years, wouldn't do so again for another 100 years. Reversing the trend would require a dramatic change in our national priorities, with a combination of tax increases and spending cuts to reduce the deficit and invest more in our future. I said that I had hoped to pursue this course without asking more of middle-class Americans, because they had borne hardships and had been treated unfairly in the previous 12 years. But the deficit had grown far beyond the earlier estimates on which I had built my budget proposals in the campaign. Now, more Americans must contribute today so that all Americans can do better tomorrow. However, unlike what had happened in the 1980s, most of the new taxes would be paid by wealthier Americans. For the first time in more than a decade, we're all in this together. In addition to deficit reduction, my economic plan would provide incentives to businesses to create new jobs, a short-term stimulus to add 500,000 jobs right away, investments in education and training with special programs to help displaced defense workers, welfare reform, and the big increase in the EITC, Head Start opportunities and vaccinations for all children who need them, and the National Service Initiative to allow young people to earn money for college in return for serving in their communities. I acknowledged that these proposals would not be easily or quickly implemented, but when they were, we could restore the vitality of the American dream. On Wednesday night in the address to Congress, I explained the strategy behind the plan and outlined the specifics. Its guiding principles were four: to shift more public and private spending from consumption to investment in order to create more jobs, to honor work and family, to produce a budget with conservative estimates, not the unrealistic rosy scenario figures that had been used in the past, and to pay for the changes with real cuts in spending and fair taxes. To create more jobs, I proposed a permanent investment tax credit for small businesses, which employed 40% of the workforce but were creating most of our new jobs, and the establishment of community development banks and empowerment zones, two of my campaign commitments which were designed to bring new loans and investments into poor areas. I also asked for more money for roads, bridges, mass transit, high-tech information systems, and environmental cleanups to increase productivity and employment. On education, I recommended increased investments in and higher standards for public schools, and incentives to encourage more students to go to college, including my National Service Initiative. I complimented Congress on passing the Family Leave Act, and asked them to follow up with tougher child support enforcement. On crime, I asked for passage of the Brady Bill, military-style boot camps for first-time nonviolent offenders, and my proposal to put 100,000 new police on the streets. I then asked Congress to help me change the way government worked by enacting campaign finance reform and registration requirements for lobbyists and eliminating the tax deduction for lobbyists' expenses. I committed to reduce the size of the federal workforce by 100,000 and to cut administrative expenses, saving $9 billion. I asked Congress to help me slow spiraling health care costs and said we could continue modest defense downsizing, but that our responsibilities as the world's only superpower required us to spend enough to keep our military the best trained and equipped in the world. I saved taxes for last, recommending that we increase the top income tax rate from 31% to 36% on incomes over $180,000, with a 10% surcharge on incomes over $250,000. Raise the corporate income tax rate from 34 to 36% on incomes over $10 million. And the tax subsidy that made it more profitable for a company to shut down its American operations and move overseas than to reinvest at home. Subject more of the income of the best off Social Security recipients to taxation. And enact the BTU tax. The income tax rates would increase on only the top 1.2% of earners. The Social Security increase would apply to 13% of recipients, and the energy tax would cost about $17 per month for people with incomes of $40,000 or more a year. For families with incomes of $30,000 or less, the EITC would more than offset the cost of the BTU tax. The taxes and budget would enable us to reduce the deficit by about $500 billion over 5 years at present economic estimates. At the end of the speech, I did my best to bring home the magnitude of the deficit problem, pointing out that if present trends continued, within a decade the annual deficit would increase to at least $635 billion a year from this year's $290 billion, and that interest payments on our accumulated debt would become America's largest budget item, taking more than 20 cents of every tax dollar. To show I was serious about deficit reduction, I invited Alan Greenspan to sit with Hillary in the First Lady's box in the House gallery. To show he was serious about it, Greenspan came, overcoming his understandable reluctance to make what could be seen as a political appearance. After the speech, which was generally well received, all the commentators noted that I had abandoned the middle class tax cut. So I had. But a lot of my other promises were fulfilled in the economic plan. Over the next few days, Al Gore, the cabinet members, and I fanned out across the country to sell it. Alan Greenspan praised it. So did Paul Tsongas, who said the Clinton who spoke to Congress was not the Clinton he ran against. Which, of course, is what my political advisors and some congressional Democrats were worried about. There were enough important and controversial proposals in the speech to keep Congress busy for the rest of the year, not to mention the other legislation that already was or soon would be on their calendar. I knew that there would be a lot of ups and downs before the economic program passed, and that I wouldn't be able to spend all of my time pushing it. Foreign problems and domestic developments wouldn't permit it. On the home front, February ended in violence. On the 26th, a bomb exploded at Manhattan's World Trade Center, killing 6 people and injuring more than 1,000. The investigation quickly revealed it to be the work of terrorists from the Middle East who hadn't covered their tracks very well. The first arrests were made March 4th. Eventually, 6 of the conspirators were convicted in federal court in New York, and each sentenced to 240 years in prison. I was pleased with the effectiveness of our law enforcement work, but troubled by the evident vulnerability of our open society to terror. My national security team began to devote more attention to terror networks and what we could do to protect ourselves and free societies around the world against them. On February 28th, 4 agents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms were killed and 16 others wounded at the onset of a confrontation with a religious cult, the Branch Davidians, at their compound outside Waco, Texas. The Davidians were suspected of illegal firearms violations. The sect's messianic leader, David Koresh, believed he was Christ reincarnate, the only person who knew the secret of the 7 seals referred to in the book of Revelation. Koresh had almost hypnotic mind control over the men, women, and children who followed him, a large arsenal of weapons which he was obviously prepared to use, and enough food to hold out for a long time. The standoff between the Davidians and the FBI dragged out for almost 2 months. During that time, several adults and children left, but most of them stayed, with Koresh promising to surrender but always finding an excuse to delay doing so. On Sunday night, April 18th, Janet Reno came to the White House to tell me that the FBI wanted to storm the compound, apprehend Koresh and any of his followers who had taken part in the killing of the agents or some other crime, and free the rest of them. Janet said she was concerned by FBI reports that Koresh was sexually abusing children, most of them preteens, and that he might be planning a mass suicide. The FBI had also told her that it couldn't keep so many of its resources tied down in one place forever. They wanted to raid the compound the next day, using armored vehicles to break holes in the buildings, then blast tear gas into them, a maneuver they estimated would force all the members to surrender within 2 hours. Reno had to approve the assault and wanted my okay first. Several years earlier, I had faced a similar situation as governor. A right-wing extremist group had established a compound in the mountains of North Arkansas. Among the men, women, and children who lived there were two suspects wanted for murder. The people lived in several cabins, each of which had a trap door that led to a dugout from which they could fire on approaching authorities. And they had a lot of weapons to fire. The FBI wanted to storm them, too. At a meeting I convened with the FBI, our state police, and cooperating law enforcement people from Missouri and Oklahoma, I listened to the FBI's case, then said that before I could approve the action, I wanted someone who had fought in the jungles of Vietnam to fly over the place in a helicopter and make an assessment. The Battlewise veteran who made the inspection for me returned to say, "If those people can shoot at all, you'll lose 50 men in the assault." I called off the raid, put a blockade around the camp, cut off food stamp aid to the several families who had been receiving it, and prevented anyone who left the premises to get supplies from going back. Eventually, the holdouts gave in, and the suspects were apprehended with no loss of life. When Janet made her case to me, I thought we should try what had worked in Arkansas before we approved the FBI raid. She countered that the FBI was tired of waiting, that the standoff was costing the government $1 million a week, and tying up law enforcement resources needed elsewhere, that the Branch Davidians could hold out longer than the Arkansas people had, and that the possibilities of child sexual abuse and mass suicide were real, because Koresh was crazy, and so were many of his followers. Finally, I told her that if she thought it was the right thing to do, she could go ahead. The next day, as I watched CNN on television just outside the Oval Office, I saw Koresh's compound in flames. The raid had gone terribly wrong. After the FBI fired the tear gas into the buildings where the people were holed up, the Davidians started a fire. It got worse when they opened the windows to let the tear gas out and also let in a hard wind off the Texas plains, which stoked the flames. When it ended, more than 80 people had died, including 25 children. Only 9 survived. I knew I needed to speak to the press and take responsibility for the fiasco. So did D.D. Myers and Bruce Lindsay. But several times during the day when I wanted to go ahead, George Stephanopoulos urged me to wait, saying we didn't know whether anyone was still alive or whether, if Koresh heard my words, he might snap and kill them too. Janet Reno did appear before the cameras, explained what happened, and took full responsibility for the raid. As the first woman to hold the Attorney General's post, she thought it was important not to pass the buck. By the time I finally talked to the press about Waco, Reno was being praised, and I was being criticized for letting her take the fall. For the second time in less than 24 hours, I had accepted advice that ran counter to my instincts. I didn't blame George. He was young and cautious and had given me his honest, albeit mistaken, opinion. But I was furious at myself, first for agreeing to the raid against my better judgment, then for delaying a public acknowledgement of responsibility for it. One of the most important decisions a president has to make is when to take the advice of the people who work for him and when to reject it. Nobody can be right all the time, but it's a lot easier to live with bad decisions that you believed in when you made them than with those your advisors say are right, but your gut says are wrong. After Waco, I resolved to go with my gut. Perhaps one reason I didn't trust my instincts enough is that the administration was being hammered hard in Washington, and I was being second-guessed at every turn. After a great initial appearance on Capitol Hill, Hillary was being criticized for the closed meetings of her health care task force. Since they were consulting with hundreds of people, nothing they did was secret. They were simply trying to move with dispatch over many immensely complicated matters to reach my overly ambitious goal of presenting a health care plan to Congress within 100 days. The task force heard testimony from over 1,100 groups, had more than 200 meetings with members of Congress, and held public meetings all around the country. Its reputation for being secretive was exaggerated. In the end, the task force operation proved too unwieldy and was allowed to expire, and we couldn't make the 100-day deadline anyway. As if all this weren't enough, I also suffered the defeat of my short-term stimulus package, which was designed to create 500,000 jobs by getting money out quickly to cities and states for infrastructure projects. The economy was still growing slowly. It needed the boost, and the modest non-recurring expenditures wouldn't have made our deficit problem worse. The House passed the bill handily, and the Senate was for it too, but Bob Dole had more than 40 Republican senators who were willing to filibuster it. After the first filibuster vote, we should have tried to negotiate a smaller package with Dole, or accepted a less ambitious compromise proposal offered by Senators John Breaux and David Boren, two conservative Democrats. Senator Robert Byrd, who was handling the proposal, was adamant that if we didn't bend, we could break the filibuster. But we couldn't, and finally admitted defeat on April 21st, 2 days after Waco. In my first term, the Republicans resorted to the filibuster to an unprecedented extent, thwarting the will of the congressional majority out of either conviction or a desire to prove that I couldn't lead. Senator George Mitchell had to have 12 votes to break filibusters just in my first 100 days. On March 19th, we suffered a personal blow that put politics in perspective when Hillary's dad had a massive stroke. Hillary rushed to his bedside at St. Vincent's Hospital in Little Rock with Chelsea and my brother-in-law, Tony. Dr. Drew Kampouras, Hugh's doctor and our friend, told Hillary that her father had suffered severe brain damage and was in a deep coma from which in all probability he would never emerge. I got there 2 days later. Hillary, Chelsea, Dorothy, and his sons, Hugh and Tony, had been taking turns talking, even singing to Hugh, who looked as if he was just sleeping peacefully. We didn't know how long he would last, and I could stay only a day. I left Hillary in the good company of her family, the Thomasons, Carolyn Huber, who had known Hugh ever since her days as the administrator of the governor's mansion, and Lisa Caputo, Hillary's press secretary, and a favorite of Hugh's because, like him, she came from eastern Pennsylvania, near his hometown of Scranton. The next Sunday, I flew home again for a couple of days. I wanted to be with my family, even though there was nothing to do but wait. The doctor told us that Hugh was essentially brain dead. Over the weekend, the family decided to take him off the machine that was breathing for him, and we all said prayers and goodbyes. But Hugh didn't go for it. His strong old heart just kept beating. Though I had been able to attend to most of my duties in Arkansas, I had to return to Washington on Tuesday. I hated to leave, knowing it was the last time I'd ever see my father-in-law. I loved Hugh Rodham with his no-nonsense gruffness and fierce family loyalty. I was grateful that he had accepted me into the fold 20 years earlier, when I was scruffy, penniless, and worst of all, a Democrat. I would miss our pinochle games and political arguments, and just knowing he was around. On April 4th, with Hugh still hanging on, Hillary had to return to Washington, too, to get Chelsea back to school after spring break and to get back to work. She had promised to give a speech on April 6th at the University of Texas at Austin for Liz Carpenter, who had been Lady Bird Johnson's press secretary. Liz pressed her not to cancel, and she decided to go. At a time when she was grief-stricken, she reached deep inside herself to say that as we moved into the new millennium, we need a new politics of meaning. We need a new ethos of individual responsibility and caring. We need a new definition of civil society which answers the unanswerable questions posed by both the market forces and the governmental ones as to how we can have a society that fills us up again and makes us feel that we are part of something bigger than ourselves. Hillary had been moved to make this argument by reading an article written by Lee Atwater shortly before he died at 40 of cancer. Atwater had become famous and feared for his ruthless attacks on Democrats while working for Presidents Reagan and Bush. As he faced death, he found that a life devoted only to getting power, wealth, and prestige left a lot to be desired, and he hoped that in a parting shot he could push us to a higher purpose. In Austin on April 6th, bearing her own sorrow, Hillary tried to define that purpose. I loved what she said and was proud of her for saying it. The next day, Hugh Rodham died. We had a memorial service for him in Little Rock, then took him home to Scranton for the funeral at the Court Street Methodist Church. I eulogized the man who had put aside his Republican convictions to work for me in 1974, and who, through a lifetime of learning from personal experience, had let go of all the bigotries he had grown up with. He lost his racism when he worked with a black man in Chicago. He lost his homophobia when he was befriended and looked after by his gay neighbors, a doctor and a nurse, in Little Rock. He had grown up in football-fanatical eastern Pennsylvania, where the Catholic stars went to Notre Dame and the Protestant ones like him played for Penn State. The divide revealed a prejudice against Catholics that was also part of Hugh's upbringing. He gave that up, too. We all thought it fitting that his last days were spent at St. Vincent's Hospital, where the Catholic nuns took loving care of him. Chapter 32. Though most of the headlines of my early months in office concerned the effort to define, defend, and pass my economic plan, gaze in the military, and Hillary's health care work, foreign policy was always there, an ever-present part of my daily routine and concern. The general impression among Washington observers was that I wasn't too interested in foreign affairs and wanted to spend as little time as possible on them. It's true that the overwhelming focus of the campaign had been on domestic issues. Our economic troubles demanded that. But as I said over and over, increasing global interdependence was erasing the divide between foreign and domestic policy, and the New World Order President Bush had proclaimed after the fall of the Berlin Wall was rife with chaos and big unresolved questions. Early on, my national security advisor, Tony Lake, had declared that success in foreign affairs is often defined by preventing or diffusing problems before they develop into headaches and headline grabbers. If we do a really good job, he said, the public may never know it, because the dogs won't bark. When I took office, we had a whole kennel full of barking hounds, with Bosnia and Russia howling the loudest, and several others, including Somalia, Haiti, North Korea, and Japan's trade policy, growling in the background. The breakup of the Soviet Union and the collapse of communism in the Warsaw Pact nations raised the prospect that Europe might become democratic, peaceful, and united for the first time in history. Whether it would happen turned on four great questions. Would East and West Germany be reunited? Would Russia become a truly democratic, stable, non-imperial nation? What would happen to Yugoslavia, a cauldron of diverse ethnic provinces, which had been held together by the iron will of Marshal Tito? And would Russia and the former communist countries be integrated into the European Union and the transatlantic NATO alliance with the United States and Canada? By the time I became president, Germany had been reunited under the visionary leadership of Chancellor Helmut Kohl With the strong support of President Bush, and despite reservations in Europe about the political and economic power of a resurgent Germany, the other three questions were still open, and I knew that one of my most important responsibilities as president was to see that they were answered correctly. During the election campaign, both President Bush and I had supported aid to Russia. At first, I was more assertive than he was, but after prodding by former President Nixon, Bush announced that the G7, the seven largest industrial nations, the United States, Germany, France, Italy, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Japan, would provide $24 billion to support democracy and economic reform in Russia. By the time Yeltsin came to Washington in June 1992 as Russia's president, he was grateful and openly supporting Bush's re-election. As I mentioned earlier, Yeltsin did agree to a courtesy meeting with me at Blair House on June 18th, thanks to the friendship between Foreign Minister Andrei Kozyrev and Toby Gatti, one of my foreign policy advisors. It didn't bother me that Yeltsin was supporting Bush. I just wanted him to know that if I won, I would support him. In November, a couple of days after the election, Yeltsin called to congratulate me and to urge me to come to Moscow as soon as possible to reaffirm America's support for his reforms in the face of mounting opposition at home. Yeltsin had a hard row to hoe. He had been elected president of Russia in June 1991, when Russia was still part of the crumbling Soviet Union. In August, Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev was put under house arrest at his summer retreat on the Black Sea by conspirators intent on staging a coup d'etat. Russian citizens took to the Moscow streets in protest. The defining moment of the drama came when Yeltsin, in office for just 2 months, climbed on a tank in front of the Russian White House, the parliamentary building under siege by the coup plotters. He urged the Russian people to defend their hard-won democracy. In effect, he was telling the reactionaries, "You may steal our freedom, but you'll have to do it over my dead body." Yeltsin's heroic clarion call galvanized domestic and international support, and the coup failed. By December, the Soviet Union had dissolved into a collection of independent states, and Russia had taken the Soviet seat on the United Nations Security Council. But Yeltsin's problems were not over. Reactionary elements, smarting from their loss of power, opposed his determination to withdraw Soviet troops from the Baltic nations of Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia. Economic disaster loomed as the rotting remains of the Soviet economy were exposed to free market reforms, which brought inflation and the sale of state-owned assets at low prices to a new class of ultra-rich businessmen called oligarchs, who made America's robber barons of the late 19th century look like Puritan preachers. Organized crime networks also moved into the vacuum created by the collapse of the Soviet state and spread their tentacles across the globe. Yeltsin had destroyed the old system, but had not yet been able to build a new one. He also had developed a good working relationship with the Duma, Russia's parliament, partly because he was by nature averse to compromise, partly because the Duma was full of people who longed for the old order or an equally oppressive new one rooted in ultranationalism. Yeltsin was up to his ears in alligators, and I wanted to help him. I was encouraged to do so by Bob Strauss, whom President Bush had sent to Moscow as our ambassador, even though he was an ardent Democrat and a former chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Strauss said I could work with Yeltsin and give him good political advice, and he urged me to do both. I was inclined to accept Yeltsin's invitation to go to Russia, but Tony Lake said Moscow shouldn't be my first foreign stop, and the rest of my team said it would divert attention from our domestic agenda. They made strong arguments, but the United States had a big stake in Russia's success, and we sure didn't want hardliners, either communist or ultranationalist, in control there. Boris made it easier when he suggested a meeting in a mutually acceptable third country. About this time, I persuaded my old friend and Oxford housemate, Strobe Talbot, to leave Time magazine and come to work in the State Department to help us with policy on the former Soviet Union. By then, Strobe and I had been discussing Russian history and politics for almost 25 years. Ever since he translated and edited Khrushchev's memoirs, Strobe had known and cared more about Russia and the Russian people than anyone else I knew. He had a fine analytical mind and a fertile imagination behind his proper professorial facade, and I trusted both his judgment and his willingness to tell me the unvarnished truth. There was no position in the State Department hierarchy that described what I wanted Strobe to do, so he set out to create one with the blessing of Warren Christopher and the help of Dick Holbrook, an investment banker and veteran foreign policy hand who had provided advice during the campaign and who would become one of the most important figures in my administration. Eventually, Strobe's new job had a title, Ambassador at Large and Special Advisor to the Secretary of State on the new independent states of the former Soviet Union. He later became Deputy Secretary of State. I don't think five people could repeat Strobe's title, but everybody knew what he did. He was our go-to man on Russia. For 8 years, he was by my side in all my meetings with Presidents Yeltsin and Vladimir Putin, 18 with Yeltsin alone. Since Strobe spoke fluent Russian and took copious notes, his participation with me and his own interactions with the Russians guaranteed a precision and accuracy in our work that would prove invaluable. Strobe chronicles our 8-year odyssey in his book, The Russia Hand, which is remarkable not only for its insights, but for the verbatim accounts of the colorful conversations I had with Yeltsin. Unlike what happens in most books of the genre, the quotes are not reconstructions. They are, for good or ill, what we actually said. Strobe's main point is that I became my own Russia hand, because while not an expert on Russia, I knew one big thing on the twin issues that had constituted the casus belli of the Cold War: democracy versus dictatorship at home and cooperation versus competition abroad. Yeltsin and I were, in principle, on the same side. During the transition period, I had talked to Strobe a lot about the deteriorating situation in Russia and the imperative of averting disaster. At Renaissance weekend, Strobe and his wife Brooke, who had campaigned full-time with Hillary and was about to become head of the White House Fellows Program, were jogging with me on Hilton Head Beach. We wanted to talk about Russia, but the leader of our group, the great Olympic hurdler Edwin Moses, set such a brisk pace that I couldn't keep up and talk at the same time. We came upon Hillary taking her morning walk, so the three of us had an excuse to slow down and visit. President Bush was in Moscow signing the START II treaty with Yeltsin. It was good news, though like everything progressive Yeltsin did, it was facing strong opposition in the Duma. I told Strobe that things were changing so much in Russia that we couldn't have a completely defensive strategy. We had to help solidify and accelerate positive developments, especially those that would improve the Russian economy. In February, I went over to Strobe's house one night to see his family and talk about Russia. Strobe told me about a recent meeting he had had with Richard Nixon, in which the former president had urged us to support Yeltsin heavily. The $24 billion assistance package President Bush had announced the previous spring hadn't done that, because the international financial institutions wouldn't release the money until Russia had restructured its economy. We needed to do something now. In early March, Yeltsin and I agreed to meet on April 3rd and 4th in Vancouver, Canada. On March 8th, Richard Nixon called on me at the White House to urge me personally to support Yeltsin. After a brief visit with Hillary and Chelsea, in which he reminded them that he was raised a Quaker and that his daughters, like Chelsea, had gone to Sidwell Friends School, he got down to business, saying I would be remembered as president more for what I did with Russia than for my economic policy. Later that night, I called Strobe to report on the Nixon conversation and to stress again how important it was that we do something at Vancouver to help Russia, with a high-impact follow-up at the annual G7 summit in Tokyo in July. All through March, as I got updates from our foreign policy team and Larry Summers and his assistant David Lipton at Treasury, I pushed them to think bigger and do more. Meanwhile, in Moscow, the Duma was reducing Yeltsin's power and endorsing the fruitless inflationary policies of the Russian Central Bank. On March 20th, Yeltsin struck back with a speech announcing a public referendum for April 25th to determine whether he or the Duma ran the country. Until then, he said his presidential decrees would remain in effect, no matter what the Duma did. I watched the speech on one of two television sets in my private dining room off the Oval Office. The other TV was showing the NCAA tournament basketball game between the Arkansas Razorbacks and St. John's University. I had a dog in both hunts. My entire foreign policy team and I had a vigorous debate about how I should respond to Yeltsin's speech. They all cautioned restraint because Yeltsin was stretching the limits of his constitutional authority and because he might lose. I disagreed. Yeltsin was in the fight of his life against the old communists and other reactionaries. He was going to the people with a referendum, and I didn't care about the risk of losing. I reminded our team that I had lost plenty of times myself. I had no interest in hedging my bets and instructed Tony Lake to draft a statement of strong support. When he presented it to me, I made it even stronger and gave it to the press. In this case, I went with my gut instincts and placed a bet that Russia would stick with Yeltsin and stay on the right side of history. My optimism was bolstered by Arkansas's come-from-behind victory in the ballgame. Finally, in March, I got an assistance program I could support, $1.6 billion in direct aid to help Russia stabilize its economy, including money to provide housing for decommissioned military officers, positive work programs for now underemployed and frequently unpaid nuclear scientists, and more assistance in dismantling nuclear weapons under the recently enacted Nunn-Lugar program, food and medicine for those suffering from shortages, aid to support small business and independent media outlets, non-governmental organizations, political parties, and labor unions, and an exchange program to bring tens of thousands of students and young professionals to the United States. The aid package was four times what the previous administration had allocated and three times what I had originally recommended. Although a public poll said that 75% of the American people were opposed to giving Russia more money, and we were already in a hard fight for the economic plan, I felt we had no choice but to press ahead. America had spent trillions of dollars in defense to win the Cold War. We couldn't risk reversal over less than $2 billion and a bad poll. To the surprise of my staff, the congressional leaders, including the Republicans, agreed with me. At a meeting I convened to push the plan, Senator Joe Biden, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, strongly endorsed the aid package. Bob Dole came around on the argument that we didn't want to foul up the post-Cold War era the way the victors in World War I had done. Their short-sightedness contributed mightily to World War II, in which Dole had served so heroically. Newt Gingrich was passionately in favor of helping Russia, saying it was a great defining moment for America, and we had to do the right thing. As I told Strobe, Newt was trying to out-Russia me, which I was only too happy to have him do. When Yeltsin and I got together on April 3rd, the meeting began a little awkwardly, with Yeltsin explaining that he had to walk a fine line between receiving U.S. assistance to help Russia's transition to democracy and looking as if he was under America's thumb. When we got to the details of our aid package, he said he liked it but needed more for housing for the military people he was bringing home from the Baltic states, many of whom were actually living in tents. After we resolved that issue, Yeltsin abruptly went on the offensive, demanding that I repeal the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, a 1974 law tying U.S. trade to free immigration from Russia, and end the observance of Captive Nations Week, which highlighted Soviet domination of countries like Poland and Hungary that were now free. Both these laws were largely symbolic without real impact on our relations, and I couldn't expend the political capital to change them and at the same time succeed in getting real help to Russia. After the first session, my people worried that I'd let Yeltsin harangue me the way Khrushchev had hectored Kennedy in their famous meeting in Vienna in 1961. They didn't want me to look weak. I wasn't worried about that, because the historical analogy was flawed. Yeltsin wasn't trying to make me look bad as Khrushchev had done to Kennedy. He was trying to make himself look good against enemies at home who were trying to do him in. In the week before our summit, they had tried to impeach him in the Duma. They had failed, but the motion got a lot of votes. I could take a little bombastic posturing if it helped to keep Russia on the right road. In the afternoon, we agreed on a way to institutionalize our cooperation, with a commission headed by Vice President Gore and Russian Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin. The idea was developed by Strobe and Georgi Mamadov, the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister, and it worked better than any of us could have imagined, thanks largely to the consistent and concentrated efforts made over the years by Al Gore and his Russian counterparts in working through a host of difficult, contentious problems. On Sunday, April 4th, we met in a more formal setting to discuss security issues, with Yeltsin and his advisor sitting across the table from me and mine. As before, Yeltsin began aggressively, demanding that we change our arms control positions and open American markets to Russian products like satellite rocket launchers without requiring export controls that would prohibit Russian sales of military technology to America's adversaries like Iran and Iraq. With the help of our hard-nosed expert, Lynn Davis, I hung tough on export controls and rebuffed the arms control demands by referring them to our staffs for further study. The atmosphere brightened when we moved on to economics. I described the economics package as cooperation, not assistance, then asked Lloyd Bentsen to outline the proposals we would make to the G7 in Tokyo. Yeltsin became alarmed when he realized that we couldn't get him any money before the April 25th referendum. Though I couldn't give Boris the $500 million check he wanted, at the press conference following our final session, I made it plain that a lot of money was coming because the United States supported Russia's democracy, its reforms, and its leader. I left Vancouver with more confidence in Yeltsin and a better understanding of the magnitude of his challenges and his visceral determination to overcome them. And I liked him. He was a big bear of a man, full of apparent contradictions. He had grown up in primitive conditions that made my childhood look like Rockefeller's, and he could be crude, but he had a fine mind capable of grasping the subtleties of a situation. He would attack one minute and embrace the next. He seemed by turns coldly calculating and genuinely emotional, petty and generous, mad at the world and full of fun. Once when we were walking through my hotel together, a Russian journalist asked him if he was happy with our meeting. He responded quickly, "Happy? One cannot be happy outside the presence of a beautiful woman, but I am satisfied." As everyone knows, Yeltsin had a fondness for vodka, but by and large, in all our dealings, he was alert, well-prepared, and effective in representing his country. Compared to the realistic alternatives, Russia was lucky to have him at the helm. He loved his country, loathed communism, and wanted Russia to be both great and good. Whenever anyone made a snide remark about Yeltsin's drinking, I was reminded of what Lincoln allegedly said when Washington snobs made the same criticism of General Grant, by far his most aggressive and successful commander in the Civil War. "Find out what he drinks and give it to the other generals." When I got back to Washington, I increased the aid package again, proposing $2.5 billion for all the former Soviet states, with two-thirds going to Russia. On April 25th, a large majority of Russian voters supported Yeltsin, his policies, and his desire for a new Duma. After a little more than 100 days in office, we had made great strides in bolstering Yeltsin and Russian democracy. Unfortunately, the same could not be said about our efforts to end the slaughter and ethnic cleansing in Bosnia. In 1989, as the Soviet Union crumbled and communism's demise in Europe accelerated, the question of what political philosophy would replace it was being answered in different ways in different countries. The westernmost part of the former Soviet Empire plainly preferred democracy, a cause championed for decades by immigrants to the United States from Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and the Baltic states. In Russia, Yeltsin and other Democrats were fighting a rearguard action against communists and ultra-nationalists. In Yugoslavia, as the nation struggled to reconcile the competing claims of its ethnic and religious constituencies, Serbian nationalism prevailed over democracy under the leadership of the country's dominant political figure, Slobodan Milosevic. By 1991, Yugoslavia's westernmost provinces, Slovenia and Croatia, both predominantly Catholic, had declared independence from Yugoslavia. Fighting then broke out between Serbia and Croatia and spilled over into Bosnia, the most ethnically diverse province of Yugoslavia, where Muslims constituted about 45% of the population, Serbs were just over 30%, and Croatians about 17%. The so-called ethnic differences in Bosnia were really political and religious. Bosnia had been the meeting place of three imperial expansions: the Catholic Holy Roman Empire from the west, the Orthodox Christian movement from the east, and the Muslim Ottoman Empire from the south. In 1991, the Bosnians were governed by a coalition of national unity headed by the leading Muslim politician, Alija Izetbegović, and including the militant Serbian nationalist leader, Radovan Karadzic, a Sarajevo psychiatrist. At first, Izetbegović wanted Bosnia to be an autonomous, multi-ethnic, multi-religious province of Yugoslavia. When Slovenia and Croatia were recognized by the international community as independent nations, Izetbegović decided that the only way Bosnia could escape Serbian dominance was to seek independence too. Karadzic and his allies, who were tied closely to Milosevic, had a very different agenda. They were supportive of Milosevic's desire to turn as much of Yugoslavia as he could hold on to, including Bosnia, into a Greater Serbia. On March 1, 1992, a referendum was held on whether Bosnia should become an independent nation in which all citizens and groups would be treated equally. The result was an almost unanimous approval of independence, but only two-thirds of the electorate voted. Karadzic had ordered the Serbs to stay away from the polls, and most of them did. By then, Serb paramilitary forces had begun killing unarmed Muslims, driving them from their homes in Serb-dominated areas in the hope of carving up Bosnia into ethnic enclaves or cantons by force. This cruel policy came to be known by a curiously antiseptic name, ethnic cleansing. The European Community envoy, Lord Carrington, tried to get the parties to agree to peacefully divide the country into ethnic regions, but failed, because there was no way to do it without leaving large numbers of one group on land controlled by another, and because many Bosnians wanted to keep their country together, with the different groups living together in peace, as they had done successfully for most of the previous 500 years. In April 1992, the European Community recognized Bosnia as an independent state for the first time since the 15th century. Meanwhile, Serbian paramilitary forces continued to terrorize Muslim communities and kill civilians, all the while using the media to convince local Serbs that it was they who were under attack from the Muslims and who had to defend themselves. On April 27th, Milosevic announced a new state of Yugoslavia comprising Serbia and Montenegro. He then made a show of withdrawing his army from Bosnia while leaving armaments, supplies, and Bosnian Serb soldiers under the leadership of his hand-picked commander, Ratko Mladic. The fighting and killing raged throughout 1992, with European community leaders struggling to contain it, and the Bush administration uncertain of what to do and unwilling to take on another problem in an election year, content to leave the matter in Europe's hands. To its credit, the Bush administration did urge the United Nations to impose economic sanctions on Serbia, a measure initially opposed by Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, the French, and the British, who said they wanted to give Milosevic a chance to stop the very violence he had incited. Finally, sanctions were imposed in late May, but with little effect, as supplies continued to reach the Serbs from friendly neighbors. The United Nations also continued to maintain the arms embargo against the Bosnian government that originally had been imposed against all Yugoslavia in late 1991. The problem with the embargo was that the Serbs had enough weapons and ammunition on hand to fight for years. Therefore, the only consequence of maintaining the embargo was to make it virtually impossible for the Bosnians to defend themselves. Somehow they managed to hold out throughout 1992, acquiring some arms by capturing them from Serb forces or in small shipments from Croatia that managed to evade the NATO blockade of the Croatian coast. In the summer of 1992, as television and print media finally brought the horror of a Serb-run detention camp in northern Bosnia home to Europeans and Americans, I spoke out in favor of NATO airstrikes with U.S. involvement. Later, when it became clear that the Serbs were engaging in the systematic slaughter of Bosnian Muslims, especially targeting local leaders for extermination, I suggested lifting the arms embargo. Instead, the Europeans focused on ending the violence. British Prime Minister John Major attempted to get the Serbs to lift the siege of Bosnian towns and put their heavy weapons under UN supervision. At the same time, many private and government humanitarian missions were launched to provide food and medicine, and the United Nations sent in 8,000 troops to protect the aid convoys. In late October, just before our election, Lord David Owen, the new European negotiator, and the UN negotiator, former U.S. Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, put forward a proposal to turn Bosnia into a number of autonomous provinces that would be responsible for all government functions except defense and foreign affairs, which would be handled by a weak central government. The cantons were sufficiently numerous, with the dominant ethnic groups geographically divided in a way that Vance and Owen thought would make it impossible for the Serb-controlled areas to merge with Milosevic's Yugoslavia to form a greater Serbia. There were several problems with their plan, the two largest of which were that the sweeping powers of the canton governments made it clear that Muslims couldn't safely return to their homes in Serb-controlled areas, and that the vagueness of the canton boundaries invited continued Serb aggression intended to expand their areas, as well as the ongoing, though less severe, conflict between Croats and Muslims. By the time I became president, the arms embargo and European support for the Vance-Owen plan had weakened Muslim resistance to the Serbs, even as evidence of their slaughter of Muslim civilians and violations of human rights in detention camps continued to surface. In early February, I decided not to endorse the Vance-Owen plan. On the 5th, I met with Prime Minister Brian Mulroney of Canada and was pleased to hear him say he didn't like it either. A few days later, we completed a Bosnian policy review with Warren Christopher announcing that the United States would like to negotiate a new agreement and would be willing to help enforce it. On February 23rd, UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali agreed with me on an emergency plan to airdrop humanitarian supplies to the Bosnians. The next day, in my first meeting with John Major, he too supported the airdrops. The airdrops would help a lot of people stay alive, but would do nothing to address the causes of the crisis. By March, we seemed to be making some progress. Economic sanctions had been strengthened and seemed to be hurting the Serbs, who were also concerned about the possibility of military action by NATO. But we were a long way from a unified policy. On the 9th, in my first meeting with French President François Mitterrand, he made clear to me that, although he had sent 5,000 French troops to Bosnia as part of a UN humanitarian force to deliver aid and contain the violence, He was more sympathetic to the Serbs than I was, and less willing to see a Muslim-led unified Bosnia. On the 26th, I met with Helmut Kohl, who deplored what was happening and who, like me, had favored lifting the arms embargo. But we couldn't budge the British and the French, who felt lifting the embargo would only prolong the war and endanger the UN forces on the ground that included their troops, but not ours. Izetbegovic was also in the White House on the 26th to meet with Al Gore, whose national security aide, Leon Firth, was responsible for our success in making the embargo more effective. Both Kohl and I told Izetbegovic we were going to do our best to get the Europeans to take a stronger stand to support him. 5 days later, we succeeded in getting the United Nations to extend a no-fly zone over all of Bosnia, to at least deprive the Serbs of the benefit of their monopoly on air power. It was a good thing to do, but it didn't slow the killing much. In April, a team of U.S. military, diplomatic, and humanitarian aid personnel returned from Bosnia, urging that we intervene militarily to stop the suffering. On the 16th, the United Nations accepted our recommendation for declaring a safe area around Srebrenica, a town in eastern Bosnia, where Serb killing and ethnic cleansing had been especially outrageous. On the 22nd, at the dedication of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel publicly pleaded with me to do more to stop the violence. By the end of the month, my foreign policy team recommended that if we could not secure a Serbian ceasefire, we should lift the arms embargo against the Muslims and launch airstrikes against Serb military targets. As Warren Christopher left for Europe to seek support for this policy, the Bosnian Serb leader, Radovan Karadzic, hoping to avoid the airstrikes, finally signed the UN peace plan, even though his assembly had rejected it just 6 days earlier. I didn't believe for a minute that his signature signaled a change in his long-term objectives. At the end of our first 100 days, we were nowhere near a satisfactory solution to the Bosnian crisis. The British and French rebuffed Warren Christopher's overtures and reaffirmed their right to take the lead in dealing with the situation. The problem with their position, of course, was that if the Serbs could take the economic hit of the tough sanctions, they could continue their aggressive ethnic cleansing without fear of further punishment. The Bosnian tragedy would drag on for more than 2 years, leaving more than 250,000 dead and 2.5 million driven from their homes, until NATO air attacks, aided by Serb military losses on the ground, led to an American diplomatic initiative that would bring the war to an end. I had stepped into what Dick Holbrooke called the greatest collective security failure of the West since the 1930s. In his book To End a War, Holbrooke ascribes the failure to five factors. 1. A misreading of Balkan history, holding that the ethnic strife was too ancient and ingrained to be prevented by outsiders. 2. The apparent loss of Yugoslavia's strategic importance after the end of the Cold War. 3. The triumph of nationalism over democracy as the dominant ideology of post-communist Yugoslavia. 4. The reluctance of the Bush administration to undertake another military commitment so soon after the 1991 Iraq War. And 5. The decision of the United States to turn the issue over to Europe instead of NATO, and the confused and passive European response. To Holbrooke's list, I would add a sixth factor. Some European leaders were not eager to have a Muslim state in the heart of the Balkans, fearing it might become a base for exporting extremism, a result that their neglect made more, not less, likely. My own options were constrained by the dug-in positions I found when I took office. For example, I was reluctant to go along with Senator Dole in unilaterally lifting the arms embargo, for fear of weakening the United Nations, though we later did so in effect by declining to enforce it. I also didn't want to divide the NATO alliance by unilaterally bombing Serb military positions, especially since there were European but no American soldiers on the ground with the UN mission. And I didn't want to send American troops there, putting them in harm's way under a UN mandate I thought was bound to fail. In May 1993, we were still a long way from a solution. At the end of the first 100 days of a new presidency, the press always does an assessment of how well the new administration is doing in keeping its campaign promises and dealing with the other challenges that have arisen. The consensus of the reviews was that my initial performance was mixed. On the positive side of the ledger, I had created a National Economic Council in the White House and put together an ambitious economic program to reverse 12 years of trickle-down economics, and it was making progress in the Congress. I had signed the Family Leave Law and the Motor Voter Law to make voter registration easier, and had reversed the Reagan-Bush abortion policies, including the ban on fetal tissue research and the gag rule. I had reduced the size of the White House staff despite its increasing workload. For example, we received more mail in the first 3.5 months than had come to the White House in all of 1992. I had also ordered a reduction of 100,000 in total federal employment and put Vice President Gore in charge of finding new savings and better ways to serve the public with a Reinventing Government initiative whose considerable results would eventually prove the skeptics wrong. I had sent legislation to Congress to create my national service program, to double the earned income tax credit and create empowerment zones in poor communities, and to dramatically cut the cost of college loans, saving billions of dollars for both students and taxpayers. I had put health care reform on a fast track and had taken strong action to strengthen democracy and reform in Russia. And I was blessed with a hard-working and able staff and cabinet, who, apart from the leaks, worked well together without the backbiting and infighting that had characterized many previous administrations. After a slow start, I had filled more required presidential appointments in the first 100 days than President Reagan or President Bush had in the same period of time. Not bad, considering how cumbersome and overly intrusive the whole appointments process had become. At one point, Senator Alan Simpson, the witty Republican whip from Wyoming, joked to me that the process was so overdone that he wouldn't even want to have dinner with someone who could be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. On the negative side, I had temporarily dropped the middle-class tax cut in the face of the growing deficit, lost the stimulus program to a Republican filibuster, maintained the Bush policy of forcibly returning Haitian refugees, though we were taking in more Haitians by other means, lost the gays in the military fight, delayed presenting the health care plan beyond my 100-day goal, mishandled at least the public part of the Waco raid, and failed to convince Europe to join with the United States in taking a stronger stand in Bosnia, although we had increased humanitarian aid, strengthened sanctions against Serbia, and created an enforceable no-fly zone. One reason my scorecard was mixed was that I was trying to do so much in the face of determined Republican opposition and mixed feelings among the American people about how much government could or should do. After all, the people had been told for 12 years that government was the source of all our problems and was so incompetent it couldn't organize a two-car parade. Clearly, I had overestimated how much I could do in a hurry. The country had been going in one direction for more than a decade, living with wedge politics, reassuring bromides about how great we were, and the illusory, though fleeting, comforts of spending more and taxing less today, and ignoring the consequences for tomorrow. It was going to take more than 100 days to turn things around. In addition to the pace of change, I may have overestimated the amount of change I could achieve, as well as how much of it the American people could digest. In one post-100 days analysis, a Vanderbilt University political scientist, Erwin Hargrove, observed, "I wonder whether the president isn't spreading himself too thin." He was probably right, but there was so much to do, and I didn't stop trying to do it all at once until the voters hit me between the eyes with a 2x4 in the 1994 midterm elections. I had let my sense of urgency blot out the memory of another of my laws of politics. Everyone is for change in general, but against it in particular, when they themselves have to change. The public struggles of the first 100 days didn't occur in a vacuum. At the same time, my family was adjusting to a dramatic change in our way of life and dealing with the loss of Hillary's dad. I loved being president, and Hillary was deeply committed to her health care work. Chelsea liked her school and was making new friends. We enjoyed living in the White House, hosting the social events, and having our friends stay with us. The White House staff was getting used to a first family that kept longer and later hours. Though I came to rely on them and greatly value their service, it took me a while to get used to all the help I had in the White House. As governor, I'd lived in a mansion with a fine staff and had been driven everywhere by the state police security detail. But on weekends, Hillary and I usually cooked for ourselves and drove the car to church on Sundays. Now I had valets who laid my clothes out every morning, packed for my trips, and went along to unpack and steam the wrinkles out. Butlers who stayed late, came early, and worked weekends, serving me food and bringing me diet drinks and coffee. Navy stewards who performed those same functions when I was in the Oval Office and traveling. A kitchen staff who prepared food for us even on weekends. Ushers to take me up and down in the elevator and bring me papers to sign and memos to read at all hours. Round-the-clock medical care, and the Secret Service, who wouldn't even let me ride in the front seat, much less drive. One of the things I liked best about living in the White House was the fresh flowers that filled the residence and office spaces. The White House always had beautifully arranged flowers. It's one of the things I would miss most after I left. When we moved in, Hillary redid the little kitchen so that we could eat dinner there at night when it was just the three of us. The upstairs dining room was beautiful, but too big and formal for our taste unless we had guests. Hillary also fixed up the solarium on the third floor, a bright room that leads out to a balcony and the White House roof. We turned it into a family room. Whenever we had relatives or friends staying with us, we always gravitated to the solarium to talk, watch TV, and play cards or board games. I became addicted to Master Boggle and a game called Upwords. It's basically a three-dimensional Scrabble game in which you get more points not by using odd letters or landing on certain spaces, but by building words upon words. I tried to get my family and friends into Upwords, succeeding with some more than others. My brother-in-law Hugh played countless games of Upwords with me, and Roger liked it. But Hillary, Tony, and Chelsea preferred our old standby, Pinochle. I continued to play Hearts with my staff, and we all got hooked on a new card game that Steven Spielberg and Kate Capshaw taught us when they were visiting. It had a perfect name for Washington political life. Oh, Hell! The Secret Service had been with me since the New Hampshire primary, but once I got into the White House, I presented a challenge to them with my morning jogs. I had several jogging routes. Sometimes I drove out to Haynes Point, which had a 3-mile route around a public golf course. It was flat, but could be tough in the winter when the winds off the Potomac were strong. From time to time, I also ran at Fort McNair, which was an oval route on the grounds of the National Defense University. My favorite jog, by far, was just to run from the southwest gate of the White House to the Mall, then up to the Lincoln Memorial, back down to the Capitol, and home. I met a lot of interesting people on those runs, and never tired of running through American history. When the Secret Service finally asked me to stop because of security concerns, I did, but I missed it. To me, these public runs were a way to keep in touch with the world beyond the White House. To them, with the memory of John Hinckley's assassination attempt on President Reagan never far from their minds, and with more knowledge than I had of the hate mail I was getting, my contacts with the public were a worrisome risk to be managed. Al Gore helped me a lot in the early days, encouraging me to keep making hard decisions and put them behind me, and giving me a continuing crash course in how Washington works. Part of our regular routine was having lunch alone in my private dining room once a week. We took turns saying grace, then proceeded to talk about everything from our families to sports, books and movies to the latest items on his agenda or mine. We kept our lunch schedule up for 8 years, except when one of us was gone for several days at a stretch. Though we had a lot in common, we were very different, and the lunches kept us closer than we otherwise would have been in the Washington pressure cooker, and eased my adjustment to my new life. All things considered, I felt pretty good, personally and politically, about the first 100 days. Still, I was under a lot of stress. So was Hillary. For all our excitement and commitment, we were tired going in, not having taken any real time off after the election. Then we were denied the honeymoon traditionally given new presidents, partly because of the way the gays in the military issue surfaced early, perhaps because we made the press angry by restricting access to the West Wing. Hillary's father's death was a painful loss to her. I missed Hugh, too, and for a while it was harder for both of us to operate at the top of our games. Though we very much enjoyed the work, the physical and emotional toll of the first 100 days was considerable.
End of Disc 2.